Welcome to Startup Nation Voices, a podcast of Startup Nation Mentorship and the World Jewish Congress. Startup Nation Mentorship pairs extraordinary college student leaders with top Israeli industry and government mentors. We currently operate on 20 campuses in 6 continents and enable students to develop meaningful, lasting relationships with Israelis who are in the center of the dynamic global economy and hub of innovation. In Voices, we bring on top Israeli and international leaders to share a deeper look into their industry and personal background, exploring the importance of mentorship and partnership with Israel.
It's such a privilege to welcome Jordan Odinsky to this week's episode. Jordan, I'm excited to dig into your background and pick your brain. Jordan started his career at Our Crowd, a leading Israeli venture capital firm where he worked for 3 years. He then joined Ground Up Ventures, an early stage venture capital firm focused on the US and Israel. He was a mentor at WeWork, an angel investor in Lemonade, and he's not even 30 years old yet. I'm Ilan Arnowitz, Director of Mentor Relations and a senior at the University of Michigan. Jordan, it's great to have you on today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Of course. So tell us about your background. Specifically, how did you think about the transition from Our Crowd to Ground Up?
Yeah, it was pretty much, it just happened to have been perfect timing. When I moved from New York to Israel right out of college, like 2 weeks after graduation, started actually as an intern at Our Crowd in the marketing department. About, you know, just 5 or 6 weeks after I moved to Israel, a few weeks after that, ended up getting a full-time offer to join the marketing team. I was there for quite some time. I was there for 3 years. I oversaw a lot of growth within the business, a lot of really interesting companies, got to work on really exciting projects with really amazing people. And happens to be that one of the founding team members of Our Crowd and one of the investment partners was leaving to start Ground Up Ventures and asked me to join. So it was really a really natural progression from Our Crowd, where I was more on the value add side, more on the platform side of venture. And this was kind of a perfect opportunity to get in at the ground floor of something really exciting and to kind of contribute to building a new firm. So it was just perfect timing in the right place at the right time. And that was pretty much the progression.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, Jordan, what you've done is incredibly unique, right? You've gone out of undergrad into the world of venture. You moved across the world. I'm curious, what do you think are maybe 1 or 2 inflection points throughout your career that really shaped the trajectory of your career and of your life?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I actually think that looking back, there are really 2 main inflection points, and those were both people that I met along the way. I don't know if they want me to mention their names, but let's just say there are 2 people who I met along the way who became really, I don't know how to put it, incredible mentors for me in just teaching me about everything, about life. They're both in the venture space. I guess I could say their names. There's no harm in it. One of them is Jonathan Triest, who is the founding partner at Ludlow Ventures. And the other one is actually David Stark, who I met, who is, my partner at Ground Up. And I met both of them and, at different points in time in my career. And they are both kind of those figures who, when you speak with them, they really just help you see the world in through a different lens. They help you level up. And those were kind of the major inflection points. If I didn't meet those 2 people, I don't know where I would be. I think what was most unique about them specifically is that they think differently. They're just kind of these people who think differently and who, when you speak to them and kind of ask questions about whether it be anything from venture to, professional to personal life, they see the world through a different lens and they really just help you evaluate things differently and help you optimize differently. And their feedback was incredibly refreshing and helpful. And those were the major inflection points. I think that at least in my professional career, that after most conversations, I always felt like I walked away way smarter, and I felt like I really had an opportunity to level up.
So I'm curious to learn more about that mentorship process. So how did the relationships form? And you can speak more generally about your understanding of mentorship as a whole, but I've always been curious because I understand the importance of mentors, but the actual execution of finding a mentor is something that I've always been curious about. Is it something that you proactively, officially classify? Is it a more unofficial type of role? How should I and our listeners that may be in college think about finding mentors?
Yeah, it's a great question. And one that, I even struggle with today. There's two kinds of ways of looking at it. There's actually a great essay that Ezra Galston from Starting Line Ventures put out back when he was at Chicago Ventures, which was something along the lines of everyone needs to create a personal board of directors for themselves. And that framework, really resonated with me. It's that each person needs to find different people in their lives, different role models across different areas, across, it could be a religion, it could be professional, it could be family life, it could be different things, but a bunch of people who essentially round out your framework of life and who you could always go to and ask advice from. So that's kind of the more formal of I'm going to take a formal and active approach towards building out kind of a mentorship network, where if those people actually know that they're your mentors or whatever, that doesn't actually matter. But what matters is kind of what's in your head and the type of people that are around, when you think of I have XYZ problem, who am I going to go to? So that's one way. The other way is, I don't believe I ever told David or Jonathan that they were my mentors. I kind of just, as you kind of grow those relationships and as those relationships become more and more, I guess not natural, but I don't know, they become much more deep. I think that there's the lines between a deep friendship and mentorship kind of blur, and they kind of cross over. And I think that when you find those are the more interesting ones for me, because when you have more of an official mentor, it's more, oh, I can only ask them certain questions at, certain intervals, where you have, just a great friend. You could ask them anything, anytime, and they're always there because at the end of the day, you're buddies.
Interesting. So that's a really helpful perspective in that a mentor doesn't have to be official. It doesn't have to be this huge proposal where you're asking someone and you're bringing the flowers to ask them to be the mentor. It can be an unofficial role that is just shaped by guidance and friendship. So that's really interesting. And I think a great perspective to have. So
exactly. I just add to that. Yeah. I just add one point to that, really anyone and everyone can be a mentor. They don't have to be older than you. They could be even younger than you. There are so many people who are younger than me, and I'm pretty young myself, who I consider mentors, who I learn a ton of, a ton from. And I think that everyone should really just be approaching their relationships as viewing everyone as a potential mentor. You never know what kind of, pearls of wisdom some person's going to drop in a conversation. And so if you view kind of all your relationships as potential mentors, you'll then understand more of how they look at life and know who to approach when when you get to a crossroads in life and you need guidance.
Right, right. And I like the analogy of the board of directors, because that gets at the point that there doesn't need to be just one mentor, right? Mm-hmm. I think growing up, I thought that a mentor was the single individual that guided you on your actions. But a board of directors implies that, like you said, you can have people that guide you through every facet of life, which is obviously helpful to have that diverse perspective.
Exactly.
Amazing. So you connected with David, he became a mentor, and then he became a business partner. So tell us more about Ground Up. The firm is small with only 4 employees. So I'm curious, how has a small team helped shape Ground Up's success?
Yeah, it's funny. You don't necessarily have to, I was just reading something about this startup who, they're only 2 people, 3 people, and there was this great tweet storm from the founder and CEO of just all the huge product features that they shipped over the past 45 days. And I think there's this misconception that in order to have a lot of progress and do a lot of great things, you need a large team for that. You need a lot of manpower. And it's funny. I think that what I guess my experience has been at GroundUp is you don't need a lot of manpower. You just need a few people who work really well together and who are incredibly motivated. And so it's not necessarily about the power isn't in the number. The power is in the people themselves. Quality over quantity any day.
It sounds like what you're saying is a small team has been a benefit for GroundUp in that it's forced you to focus more on quality versus quantity. And you're able to produce the same output with fewer resources, which has led to GroundUp's success.
Yeah, exactly. I would say that, with anything, a small team forces you to be pretty frugal with your time and with your team's time. And you can't go after every opportunity and you can't go after every interesting project and interesting, marketing thing that you want to do because, a limit of time and resources and, all that fun stuff. But what a small team has enabled us to do is we're able to move faster because we're a small team. We're able to, do things that other larger teams are unable to do. There's less schedules to coordinate through. There's, less opinions around the table. They're the right opinions around the table, but less opinions around the table. So you're not necessarily, hearing things that aren't important. You're not necessarily kind of getting 1,000 different opinions and trying to figure out which one to stick with. Obviously each one has their pros and cons. For this stage of, where our firm is at, a small team has been an incredible blessing.
Amazing. And GroundUp's model is really unique in that you have this small core team, as you mentioned, but you also have a robust college ambassador program. So I'm curious to learn more about the strategy behind this model. Tell us more about the college ambassador program. And for our college students that may be listening, how can they get involved if they're interested?
Yeah, great question. So the program is called Campus Partners, and it was started by my partner, Corey, way back when, even before I joined GroundUp. And essentially the thesis back then, and I'll tell you what I believe from my personal view, what it evolved into, but the thesis back then was that there are a bunch of amazing things happening on college campuses. How many amazing companies and iconic brands were started either on campus or right after, graduation, by these really impressive people. And part of the thesis was that there are so many college kids who are looking to break into venture. What if we gave them that platform? What if we gave them that opportunity? And in return, we just train them to be our eyes and ears on campus. So they let us know of all the cool opportunities. It's kind of a win-win. And so that's what it became. It's taken a lot of different, twists and turns over the life of the program. But essentially, that's what it's always been. And I think now looking back on kind of all the different cohorts that we've had nearly 100 campus partners so far. I think what it was more than us, more than them being the eyes and ears and us picking, just anyone and everyone to be eyes and ears on campus for us. The real beauty and the real magic of the program was that we did a great job picking winners, just winners, we think that whether they're going to become founders, whether these people are going to become anything in their lives, it doesn't matter what they do, that these college kids are going to be winners. And creating that network of really incredible people who are just in the infancy of their careers is going to pay back dividends, time and time again over who knows how many years. And we may not see, the rewards of it every single day, but there's going to be a time where we do see that, where they'll vouch for us to a founder and say, hey, you should really talk to this team. So that's kind of been the magic there. What's great is to see how many of them are actually in investing roles. What's great is to see how many of them are working at startups or in innovation roles at large corporations. And what's also great is just to see that, you now have really impressive people who are just, kind of have an affinity towards the GroundUp brand. So that's kind of the pro and the magic of the Campus Partner program. We haven't run one yet since COVID hit. That's kind of taken a backseat. Like I said, as you mentioned, we're a team of four. So only a certain amount of things that we can focus on at any given time. But we'll definitely be, running a cohort in the very near future. And if anyone wants to get involved, there should be a sign-up link. I'm blanking on where it is, but anyone could just email me either. I'm jordan@groundup.vc. You could just email me. I'll forward it to you. I'll send it to you. And then when we do end up, you know, bringing back the program, like I said, in the very near future, you'll be on that list to get involved.
It really is great for the ecosystem, in my opinion, because what you're doing is you're giving students the exposure to an industry that is very hard to break into out of undergrad. And at the same time, it's great brand awareness for GroundUp. I personally first heard of GroundUp from a friend who's a campus ambassador, and college students are very eager to put impressive brands like GroundUp on their LinkedIn. So it creates this snowball effect that's beneficial to the student and beneficial to you all at GroundUp. So that's really interesting. I was really excited to pick your brain about the strategy behind that.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll just add one of the best parts of the program is I think I've personally gained maybe even more than others in terms of just meeting all, you know, really impressive college students and just being able to be a sounding board for ideas of, you know, should we, you know, try and work in venture? Should we first work in product at a startup? Or like kind of all these little questions, just kind of paying it forward of what, you know, my mentors taught me and helped me think through things. It's been probably the most rewarding thing to kind of pay that forward. And yeah, I hope I don't mess anyone up with my random advice, but I think in the few times that I've helped out, it's worked out.
I'm sure all the students have benefited greatly from the advice, and you probably only steered one or two wrong. Don't worry. So on that note of advice for college students, you've interacted with, like you said, hundreds of college students. For the college listener that would love to absorb some of your advice from what you've seen, what guidance might you have for them? Maybe they're interested in venture, maybe they're not sure. You know, what would be the general guidance and advice that you would have for a college student from what you've seen from interacting with them?
Yeah, and it goes back to your original question about mentors. And this was, I remember I was in an excellent restaurant in Jerusalem with David Stark, my partner. This is while I was at our crowd. And I asked him a similar question of there were two kind of interesting opportunities in front of me at the time. And his advice was, and I'll just kind of forward that on. So if you have a problem with it, take it up with him, but it worked out for me. His advice was, what are you trying to optimize for at the end of the day? It's so interesting because you'll see people say, I would love to do venture. And breaking into venture is kind of a whole different kind of conversation, a whole different topic. But you have people who say, I really want to do venture, but maybe the best path, you know, forward there is to go work at a startup and to, you know, get some operating experience. And his whole point at the time was, what are you optimizing for? At the end of the day, you should be doing whatever you're, you know, what are you trying to optimize for? So if you want to be a startup investor, just invest in startups. Don't go to have a distraction and go work in, you know, marketing at a startup. Just go figure out how to be the best, you know, startup investor you can be. And I think that advice, you know, has really rang true for me, at least. It's helped me think through a lot of different things. And I think that for the campus partners, you know, that have, you know, that's the same advice that I give to all the campus partners, the same advice that David gave me. You just got to figure it out at the end of the day. What are you optimizing for, you know, today? Like, I want to be X, and how do you get awesome at, you know, doing that? You don't go do Y to get awesome at X, because, you know, if you want to, you know, if you're going to go do Y, you know, go, you're going to figure out how to be awesome at Y, and like that leads you away from X. I think that if you want to figure out, you know, you have to keep your eye on the prize. If you know what you want to do, go figure out how to be the best at that and how to do that.
I really like that idea of working backwards, right? Kind of identifying the goal where you want to be in the medium to long term, and then understanding the best learning opportunities that will allow you to reach that goal. Mm-hmm. In theory, that makes a lot of sense. What I personally struggled with, and what I know a lot of my friends have struggled with when thinking about going into venture, is what about the worries of paving this path that's less traveled, right? Investment banking consulting are the traditional career paths. I'm going into venture out of undergrad, but obviously I had to weigh the pros and cons of what would I be missing by not taking a traditional career path. How do you think through that dichotomy, and what are the pros and cons of going into venture out of undergrad?
It's kind of a difficult question to answer without knowing a person's like specific situation. I think ultimately it comes down to where a person's, you know, passions lie. It's, you know, are you going to go into investment banking and hate yourself? You know, for whatever reason, for, are you going to hate your life? Are you going to, pull all these all-nighters and, you know, curse under your breath because, you know, you don't want to be here and, oh, I should have done this. I should, like, at the end of the day, everyone has to be, and this is with everything, you have to be brutally honest with yourself and say, you know, what makes me happy? What do I want to do? And that's not to say that just because venture makes you happy, you're going to get a job in venture. Like I said, breaking into venture is a different topic and everyone has their own two cents of how to do that. And no, you know, I don't think any two people's paths, you know, have been the same into venture. I think that as with everything, you have to be brutally honest and say to yourself, okay, like, you know, where, you know, maybe more unconventional to go into venture, you know, I might not have the best resources or have the best idea what that might look like. But at the end of the day, though, you know, going into venture is like something that I'm going to be excited to talk about with my friends, with my family, with anyone who's, you know, wants to listen. Like, is investment banking going to do the same for me? And if the answer is yes, then by all means, go do that, you know? But I think it's just being brutally honest with yourself about what you want and, you know, going for what you want. And hey, listen, if you can't get into venture, like maybe, you know, investment banking is a good fallback or vice versa, or, you know, either one. But yeah.
Right. So it sounds like the number one criteria that you index for when deciding through, when thinking through this decision is what would get you excited and what would get you out of bed. Because yeah. with both of these competitive industries, you're going to be working long hours. You're going to be working a lot. So at the end of the day, if you don't like your job, 2 years, 3 years is a really long time to say, I'll do this so that I can reach X. And so really you're focusing on what you're the most passionate about, which makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. I'd also add on to that, that it's really difficult to, you know, do one thing and then jump into another. Like it's really hard if you want to say, I want to go do investment banking and then I'm going to switch into venture. Or, you know, it's kind of, if you think of like the path less traveled, it's always harder to break into those paths from another industry because there aren't a lot of skills that necessarily translate. For example, you know, if you look at, I know a fraction of what an investment banker actually does, but, you know, if you look, you know, take a look at, you know, financial modeling is a huge part of that. And as a part of pre-seed investing, like it's not a huge part of, you know, the job description, financial modeling at the pre-seed stage. And so a lot of those, you know, kind of skills, like yes, the analytical skills definitely translate, but a lot of the things that you're going to be doing don't necessarily translate. If you're going to go into marketing or if you're going to go into product, like, yes, there are certain things that you'll have a better, you know, knack for seeing and discovering and understanding. But at the end of the day, does that really help you? It goes back to the same thing that David said, what are you optimizing for? And like, what do you really want to do?
Right. Right. I think that perspective is really beneficial to anyone thinking about this decision. So Jordan, you recently wrote a great Medium article. I recommend that everyone should check it out if they haven't, called Cult Wars, The Making of a Cult Brand, where you discuss brands like Apple, brands like Superhuman, what made them so addictive for people. And in it, you discuss three different characteristics, most of them being marketing focused. So I'm curious, when making a cult brand, a cult company, how do you understand the balance between product versus marketing? Can a superior marketing strategy compensate for an inferior product, which seems to be the takeaway from the article? Would love to hear your thoughts there.
Great question. I think at the early days, the answer is 100% yes. I think it's all marketing at the early days before there's a product. Remember, we have to remember that Superhuman and Rome and, you know, kind of all the different cult brands, even Barstool, take a look at. They're all companies and, you know, in the very, 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 very early days. And, you know, you aren't born a cult brand. You know, it's something that gradually happens over time. And if you look at all of them, I think that maybe with actually the exception, there are likely a handful of exceptions, but I think that overwhelmingly, it usually starts with marketing, especially at the early days. And I think that, you know, product definitely follows. I don't think that marketing is, you know, sustainable without, you know, phenomenal product. But I think in the early days, you could definitely garner the interest in, you know, creating that enemy through marketing. And I don't think product plays any role in that, or it plays a very minimal role in that. It is totally marketing word of mouth that kind of seeds the initial, we are better, we're radically different from the rest kind of messaging that really does the initial job of rallying the troops.
So then at what point does products come in? At what point will a customer realize, wow, the branding here is great, but there is a competitor that will better fit my needs, that is less hyped, but is still a better product for me?
It's funny because even when that happens, I'm just thinking of products that I use personally. Even when that happens, there are sometimes the emotional buildup that I have, and that I've built up in my head, is so strong that even if someone's offering a better value proposition at the end of the day, but yet I don't buy into their whole mantra of whatever story they're telling, I won't use it because I'm not connected to it. I'm more connected to whatever I'm using that might be inferior. And I have invested so much of my time and energy and emotional state into, believing in this, that it's almost too much energy to go ahead and back into something else. But that's to say that, cults, don't last forever. And like any good cult, any successful cult, they keep stoking the flames, So whether that's through marketing or whether that's through actually the product, I think that product definitely has to, meet up at a certain point. But I think that the great thing about cults is that at the end of the day, they want the product to succeed. And so they are the ones who are telling you exactly what they want. And, the famous thing, build things that, people want, make something that people want. They're telling you, they give you the roadmap. And I think that there's no more, if you have a real cult brand, there's no more loyal, fan base or customer base, user base, however you want to put it, that will actually put you on the roadmap towards success. So I think that product definitely has to catch up at certain points. But I think that in the early days, marketing could do much of the heavy lifting.
Got it. So really, if a marketing strategy is successful enough, it can lock someone in to such a great degree where there's almost no point of return. Even if a customer realizes that a product does not have the best value proposition, they will continue to use it. That's fascinating.
Yeah, there are obviously cohorts, though. It's interesting because, you could kind of break up any cult into different types of cohorts. So you'll have like the diehard users, the diehard fans who at all costs, they will defend, the glory of the idea of that they're searching for. Kind of in the middle, you'll have the people who are very committed, but a little bit more open-minded. And then you'll have people at the bottom who are just like, yeah, like I like this, but like I haven't done anything really to scale that commitment curve, which is the final piece of the article or the essay that I wrote. And if you haven't scaled the commitment curve, like you could be lost, for that cause. And so I think that part of a brand that, is interested in, becoming a cult. And by the way, it's funny, like a lot of people have come, have approached me and said, oh, like, what about brands being interested in becoming a cult brand or like, how would I go about it? Like all these are, it's funny because, I'm actually not sure that any of the brands that I mentioned in the beginning, thought of themselves as cults. Like, I think that it's more the community turned them into cults, but it wasn't the CEO who said, we're going to go ahead and create a cult or we're going to go like, while there is a lot of intentionality to it, I think that a lot of the intentionality is around retention, is around creating a good buzz and creating good karma around the idea that they're going after, but it's the community who essentially elected them a cult. I don't think it could work the other way around where a CEO would say, I am, a cult leader or whatever. I don't think it works that way. I think it's, it's very gradual. It happens over time where your community and your fan base and your users end up essentially pointing you and crowning you king.
Really was a great article. Again, to all of our listeners, definitely recommend checking out Jordan Odinsky on Medium and reading that in addition to his other great articles. Jordan, I could pick your brain for hours, but I'm going to let you go here. We're going to stop the podcast, but thank you so much for taking the time. I really learned a lot, and I know our listeners did too. And we look forward to seeing you next time we're in Israel or New York.
I am looking forward as well. And yeah, if anyone has any questions or anyone ever wants to chat, I'm Jordan at groundup.vc. If you know anyone who's building something cool, send them my way. And yeah, if you're interested in good vibes, just reach out.
Good vibes for Jordan Odinsky. I can attest to that. Jordan, thank you so much. Take care.
Thanks for having me.